Welcome to the Banquet Live Podcast. I'm your host, James Nethery. Regular listeners know that we create specials annually, typically Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's. And if you haven't spent time listening to them, some of them or all of them, you have an opportunity. In this episode, we've taken what we feel like are some of the best clips from previous Halloween specials, put them together all in one place for you to enjoy. So thank you for listening, and we do hope you enjoy it. My encouragement is, listen, don't make financial decisions based on sound bites. Don't do it. Go ahead and take the opportunity. Take the time. Make the time to investigate for yourself this idea of becoming your own banker, that you can become your own banker. Explore the idea that you can control the banking function. And if you take the time and explore it, right, and you determine that it's worth implementing in your life, get to it. If you decide, no, nah, it's too complicated or I'm not interested, no problem. But just take the time. Don't make decisions based on drive-by innuendos, soundbite accusations, right? Just because somebody is arrogant, they come across confident, and they're bullying the listener, you know, it doesn't mean they're right. Okay, but it's a hallmark, right? No license. Commissions are bad. The character of anybody who really does anything other than what they do, mainly life insurance agents, it's bad. And you got to buy term and invest the difference. And then, of course, they've got to villainize the life insurance companies, except for the ones they promote, right? They just have to villainize, you know, the life insurance company's got to be a bad guy. And from my position, my opinion, what I've come to understand and believe, it's almost like the mutual life insurance companies are against the world when it comes to financial markets. And that pool of mutual companies is shrinking as we speak, right? Wonder why? Well, when you look, the mutual companies are with whole life, dividend paying whole life, dividend, you know, participating policies. It produces a lesser return comparatively to term insurance and universal life insurance for the insurance companies. Right? So fewer and fewer companies want to make less whenever they can go right term and universal life and get a higher rate of return. So I'm just saying that the idea of becoming your own banker with mutual companies is worth investigating. Why a mutual company, James? Well, because the policy owner is the owner of the company. So all companies in the free world, and when we practice capitalism, companies are in business for two things, for two fundamental reasons. Number one, they want to make a profit. How do they make a profit? They provide services and products to their consumers, right? Well, if they don't do a good job and they don't get a government subsidy, they're going to be out of business, right? So they're incentivized to deliver good products and good services. Well, who's the owner of these mutual companies? Oh, it's a policyholder. Okay. So when the company has a positive financial experience in a given year, some of that revenue is shared with the owner through a dividend. Yeah, okay. But then, you know, they also argue that, you know, dividends are just a return of a premium, overpayment of premium. Yep, that's how it's classified in the Internal Revenue Code. And that's okay. I don't care how you classify it. Just pay me a dividend. Yeah, well, if dividends are bad, then you shouldn't buy dividend-producing stocks, right? So it's okay to like buy Home Depot stock, right? Ownership position, and not receive a dividend? Or would you want to receive a dividend? So would you want to be a consumer of and an owner of the same company? Yeah, I think so, especially when it comes to life insurance. I don't know about the other companies. But the insurance companies have to be villainized, right? It's very common to hear, well, you know, the life insurance company keeps your cash value when you die. No kidding, right? Because the cash value is the cash value. The death benefit is the death benefit. Now, there is a universal life product, option A, level death benefit, option B, increasing death benefit. It's not complicated. Who's paying for that increasing cost of the death benefit? You, the policyholder. Okay, so let's don't cloud the issue or overcomplicate it, because it really doesn't have to be. So what is the cash value? Talked about this many times. I've talked about these things many times on the free, no cost videos that are available on my channel. It's okay to take time and learn or thoroughly vet the idea. Just check it out. See if this is an idea worthy of your implementation. If it is, great, get to it. If it's not, great, no problem. Right? The cash value is the net present value of a future death benefit minus future premiums. So whenever you die, who keeps the cash value? Oh, wait a minute. The cash value is the net present value of a future death benefit. So when the death benefit is paid, that death benefit is made up partially of the cash value. Is that complicated? No. We don't even have to get above third grade math. But let's talk about an example that I like to use. Let's say you have a home that's worth $500,000 market value. You have $300,000 in equity. You sell your home for $500,000. Who, pray tell, financial entertainer, who kept that $300,000 in equity? What mean, evil, dirty scoundrel kept that money? Because we need to hunt them down, find them, and string them up, right? Put them on trial. Okay. Well, who was it? Was it the seller's agent that earns that dirty commission? All the hard work, you real estate agents, you realtors, you know what I'm talking about. Hard work, you earn every penny that you earn, and good job, keep doing it, okay? Was it the buyer's agent or the seller's agent? Who kept that? Was it the lender, the buyer's lender? Did they keep that $300,000 in equity? Was it the seller's lender? Who kept the $300,000, Mr. Entertainer? Oh, yeah, it's silent, of course. It was in the sales price of the home or the property. Okay. Well, if I had a $500,000 death benefit with a cash value whole life insurance policy of $300,000 in cash value, I graduate. My beautiful wife receives $500,000 income tax free, might I add. Who do we need to string up that kept that $300,000? Oh, it was part of the death benefit. Oh, okay. So these drive-by accusations, when you get all revved up and triggered, and by all means, I know how to get triggered, okay? When you boil them down, it's like cloak and dagger, smoke and mirrors, right? You got to vilify somebody to buy into your program. Okay, well, it obviously works, right? They're going to keep doing it. Why? Because it pays, right? Yeah, somebody's getting paid very well, right, Mr. Entertainer? Yeah. So why would they quit? They're not incentivized to quit. They're going to continue. Why? Because it pays well. Okay, fair enough. Another one, very common, is why would you ever pay interest to borrow your own money? Seems like a legitimate, fair question, doesn't it? Yeah, but it can't hold up under scrutiny and consideration. So it's either ignorant, right? Or there is knowledge. And then if there's knowledge there and they're not ignorant, then it becomes a moral issue, because then it's a character issue. Okay, let's be clear. Whenever you pay a premium to a life insurance company, it is not your money. You're fulfilling an obligation, at least partially, because a premium is an obligation to the insured or the policy holder, the policy owner. You buy life insurance, it's a contract, right? You're going to pay a premium, that's an obligation, right? And the life insurance company is going to assume the risk of you dying too soon, right? Because we're all trying to work and accumulate money for, you know, passive income time in the future, for example. So if you die and you didn't have the time to accumulate all that capital, the death benefit is replacing that future income that died with you and paid tax-free to your beneficiary, right? Now, along the way, if you have whole life insurance, and I understand universal life does have an account value, and it's also called permanent, but I'm not talking about universal life. We'll talk about that later with all the other financial gurus, okay? I'm talking about permanent whole life insurance that has a cash value. Issued by a mutual company that pays dividends. Okay, I have that cash value. You know, there's a loan provision in that life insurance contract where the owner has the right to collateralize that cash value. Okay. So whenever I pay a premium, that premium is no longer mine. It is not my money. It is the property of the life insurance company. Now, within that contract, a portion of that premium creates a cash value, and the cash value is guaranteed to grow over time. So as that cash value accumulates, that contract has a loan provision in it. So I can dang near demand one service form, one multi-purpose service form. I can even go online now and request a loan. And I'm not asking the company to approve the loan. I'm not asking them anything. I'm telling them, this is what I want, and this is where I want you to send it. That's the only thing they ask me, if they ask me anything. Well, do you want us to mail you the check? Do you want us to, you know, deposit the check into your checking account? So let's be clear, that is not my money. Right, so I'm not paying interest on my own money. But it's okay if I did practice EVA, economic value added. It's okay for me to value my capital if I'm going to value the third-party lender's capital that didn't exist until I signed the dotted line, right? I mean, why would I pay a credit card 10, 12, 14, 15, 20, 30% or a line of credit 5, 6, 8, 10, and 15% or a HELOC at 3.5, 4, 4.5, 5 or higher? And I won't value my own capital? Yeah, there's some kind of a conflict of philosophy right there. Here's an email question. My heart kind of goes out to this guy somewhat. It's kind of a long question and he's very nice. He says he just discovered the podcast, started watching all of them. He currently has four infinite banking type policies that he has funded over for over a year now. And he's listening to the podcast and he's looking for a particular podcast that may teach or explain how this additional interest is paid into a policy. And I think that's page 58 in Becoming Your Own Banker Interest. What we call additional interest to a policy is really premium to the life insurance company. It's interest. What we're calling interest is our deal, and it's more capital to your system, right? But that's what his question, and it's kind of a long question. But he's like, he can't figure out from Nelson's book, Becoming Your Own Banker. Oh yeah. Page 58. He discusses paying back the loan with greater interest rate than the loan rate to get more, you know, premium into the policy. He understands it's a policy. He understands that and he would like to do it, but he doesn't understand the mechanics of how to do it actually. And then he goes on to explain, you know, if I borrow and I pay back five, well, I think you've got it. And I answered this email directly, but Paul, you have it. Your policy won't allow you to pay additional unscheduled PUA payments. And if you did, you're going to have to go through underwriting. Oh, they didn't tell you that though, right? They use the infinite banking concept, right? They use IBC. They talk about Nelson and all day long, but then they can't show you how to do that. I'm shocked. So, but you'll be fine. And I actually gave him the answer, you know, what he might consider doing. There are ways you can manage that. Okay. So what? You can't get additional premium into your life insurance policy, but you want to pay additional interest, quote unquote, into your system. There's a way to do that. And maybe it's a segregated checking account, right? Which there's more content out there on that, but that would be a solution. And then, you know, if you did that, that segregated checking account winds up with a bunch of money that you couldn't get into your existing policies without going through underwriting or any other method. Maybe it's time to expand. Maybe it's not, but maybe it is, right? That's a reoccurring event where I'm accumulating a lot of money in a side account that's within my banking system and all my policies are full and I can't repay loans. It might be a natural signal to expand. Okay. What a concept. And oh my gosh, did I mention natural? Yeah, that's really, look, the infinite banking concept is really, the human action at the you and me level. I mean, it is a natural way to handle and interact with one's finances. It's a beautiful thing. Okay. But thank you for listening, Paul. Keep listening, sir. Well, here, I got one. I got one. Look, I love this.
Oh, yeah.
Why do you say the cash value grows tax deferred? Shouldn't it be tax free? Oh my gosh, if you're a life insurance agent, shouldn't you already know this question? Okay. No, I correctly stated, and because it's correct, is why I said cash value grows tax deferred. That's actually correct. Cash value grows tax deferred. And that's why I said it. Yeah. Is it accessible tax free? Yes, it is.
Right.
I mean, I speak English. She reads and speaks English. I mean,
and the reason we say tax, the reason it is tax deferred is that if you were to generate cash value inside of your contract in excess of your cost basis or the amount of premium you paid in since day one of the contract, and you were to then surrender that contract prior to your graduation, then the difference between the high cash surrender value and the premium that you paid in, that differential there is a taxable gain. And so at that point, you would have, from the time the contract originated to the time you surrendered, you would have deferred taxation on the inside buildup of the cash value in that contract. So technically speaking, the nature of cash value from a legal perspective, not a lawyer, this isn't legal, I'm just someone who can read, that's all, right? the technical nature of cash value growth is that it's tax deferred. Now, can you borrow against the tax deferred growth using a tax-free instrument in the form of a policy loan? Yes, you can, right? So, you know, square that away, however legalistic you want to be about it, the technical nature of cash value growth is that it's tax deferred and you can get to it in a tax-free manner. So, you know.
Thank you.
Look, you can call that a banana. Whatever you want to call it is what it is. And it's not like we don't know the difference.
You
know?
It's like, look, why do you say cash value grows tax deferred? Because it's true. And then comment, shouldn't it be tax-free? Yes, it should. But the federal government has no restraint, right? And they create no... They create no profit, right? So the federal government doesn't know what a profit is. So yeah. And they have no restraint on your property. All right. So should it be tax free? Yes, of course it should be tax free.
Everything should be tax free.
Yeah. So and why is it not? Is because your federal government, state government, local government, city, county, parish has no restraint. And oh my gosh. No kidding. Like, that's a revelation, right?
Yeah.
The 10th Amendment, right? You know, it's like an entity that can't, the federal government doesn't even have the ability to restrain itself. The state cannot. It does not have the ability to restrain itself. And by expansion, it needs your capital and your property. So... And I could go on and on about that, but I digress. I'll let my libertarian friends blow it up on that one.
I know nothing about finance. All right. So then the next...
I'm going to turn that volume up. I want everybody to hear that comment. Okay.
Another...
Look, this whole episode is turning into this one...
It's the Halloween episode. Frightening comments.
I could talk about an awful lot of things that are scary in the big wide world, especially when it comes to money. And I think the first thing I want to talk about or bring up or just point out is how scary our banking system is today in the big wide world. You know, here we have a banking system worldwide, right? The Federal Reserve, all the central banks around the world, they're all privately owned and they're controlling the money supply of every country on this earth. And therefore controlling the governments. I don't know. I don't want to be too conspiratorial, but the banking function is in the hands of the wrong people, No question about that. Now, if we talk about just banking in general, right, the movement of money is all it is. And I know the local bank in the town that you live in, those are upstanding citizens and, you know, nothing disparaging about them, their character, their personality, or anything like that. However, just consider the fact that there are zero reserve requirements currently in our banking system. Here, this is our fifth Halloween episode, 2024. So, in 2024, there are no reserve requirements for a bank. You know, we're all accustomed to hearing, a bank can lend out 10 times their deposit. You put $1,000 in the bank, they can lend out $10,000, creating that money out of thin air, which is scary in and of itself, right? So their reserve requirement would be $10,000. You put $1,000 in, they can lend out $10,000. No, there is no reserve requirement today. Just chew on that. They can print all the money they want to print, and they do, without any requirements. Now, they print money out of thin air, right? They expand the money supply, causes inflation, another very scary thing, inflation, right? An expansion of the money supply. Well, that gives the appearance that the price of goods and services increase. You know, that's what it looks like, right? I bought, you know, a car last year for $25,000. Now it costs $40,000, whatever the case may be. No. It's the purchasing power of the dollar that's declining. The car didn't go up in value. The car probably went down in value, right? It was cheaper to produce it this year than it was last year. It's the purchasing power of the dollar. So if you go back 1913, when the first central bank and the third central bank in America was created, 1913, right? The dollar was worth a dollar, right? Today, it's worth less than 2 cents in comparison to the 1913 dollar, comparing it to the 2024 dollar. It's because of the expansion of the money supply causes all of the value of all of the dollars in existence to go down, which then requires more of them to make a purchase. So it looks like the price is going up. No. It's the expansion of the money supply. It's inflation. And I think if people understood that today, across the country, things may change. But I don't know. We'll see. Now, but think about that. Not only is that spooky, creating money out of thin air, it is even worse if you charge money, interest, to loan this money that didn't exist. That's beyond the Twilight Zone. You know, Nelson Nash said, banks lend money that doesn't exist, and that is evil. Banks charge interest on money that didn't exist, and that is evil. So let's just walk through this for a moment. You walk into the bank, you want to borrow some money for a car, and number one, the car, if they give you the loan, the car is going to be collateralized. They want to lend you $10,000. The car better be worth more than $10,000. When you sign your John Henry on that note, you receive the money, go buy the car. Not only have you over-collateralized the loan, not only with real assets, car's a real thing, but you've also collateralized that loan with your future production, because the banker knows full well the reason why they're over collateralizing the loan. He knows full well the value of the car is going to go down, and you're probably not going to repay it anyway, right? So the banking system that we enjoy today is truly scary. It's truly off into the Twilight Zone. And the deeper you look at that and look into the history of it, if you wish, it just looks worse and worse. You know, but it's pretty scary. The state of our educational system today is pretty scary. The fact that there is little to no financial education in America today is scary. It's not only scary, it's a tragedy. Right. And we've talked about it before on this channel. You look at the top 50 personal finance books, personal finance, retirement planning, investing, whatever. The top 50 personal finance books do not talk about banking. They don't talk. They don't. They just act like it doesn't exist. They don't. They do not address it, and it was never clearly addressed until Nelson Nash came along and wrote the book "Becoming Your Own Banker" and published it in 2000. Right. So if we understood, or not if we understood, if we knew that there was a banking function going on, and then we didn't do anything about it, we didn't learn about it through traditional education, that's for sure. But we're aware that a banking function is in our life, and then we don't do anything about it, we're abdicating our responsibility to control the banking function. Abdication of that responsibility is extremely scary because it's costing you money. Whether you realize how much it is or whether you realize it's costing you or not, it actually, in fact, is costing you and your family a tremendous amount of money because of your abdication of the responsibility to control the banking function. And my encouragement is maybe to learn about the banking function. How much of the banking function do you control as it relates to you? Just consider it. And then maybe consider the fact that there's a mechanism, a way, a proven method, right? That's very sound, solid, legitimate, that you could use to control the banking function in your life. Then you could also start to see what it could possibly mean to you and all of your future generations. You know, it's a tragedy that it is a tragedy. Not only are these scary things that I'm talking about all like existing out in the big twilight zone, they're tragedies too. It's a tragedy that we're born into a debt slave construct and don't realize it until we realize it. And it takes too dang long to figure out what's really going on. You know, that's a tragedy that we're born into this debt slave construct. In my opinion, twilight zone, it's scary. And you can do something about it. And it's really, really scary if you don't. So my encouragement is that you do something about it. You know, if we consider inflation, right, the expansion of the money supply, the rising cost of goods and services, and then lending money in our banking system, lending money that didn't exist, charging interest on that money that didn't exist until you over-collateralized the loan. No real education when it comes to money and finance in America. Zero or next to zero education, maybe one, greater than zero, a little bit greater than zero, maybe. No education on banking. It's all a very scary situation. And then it's also scary that the solution exists and you're not aware of it. Right? Or you won't take the time to discover, to even look, to consider that there might be a solution there. That's pretty scary. You know, so I'm like, be brave. Go to some haunted houses, get yourself all spooked up so you can face other scary things and discover that you could possibly control the banking function in your life. And if you did, what that might mean to you. And I'm just telling you, it's going to mean an awful lot. Now, what I want to question and encourage you to think about is where your money should reside. Should it be into a qualified plan? Should it just automatically go there by default? And, you know, maybe so, but let's look at that. If I'm working hard and saving money, quote unquote, number one, an IRA or 401k, the underlying investment most of the time is some kind of a risk, mutual fund, stock, bond, you know, ETFs, EFTs. There's risk involved, right? So that's not savings, that's investing. Let's be clear, savings versus investing, you know, saving for retirement in the market is not saving, just investing. And okay, maybe we should all have some investments. There's no question about that. You're the best investment that you have. So maybe you should put money, you know, to your own education and to whatever your God-given abilities and talents are. But I digress. Looking at IRAs, 401ks, most of America is separating themselves from that pile of money, and they're abdicating their responsibility to some you know, third-party investment advisory firm or person or individual separated by probably several hundred, maybe a couple thousand miles, you're abdicating your responsibility. You're not you in personally, but in general, the big us, you know, we're all encouraged to, number one, separate ourselves from our money, put our money into this, and we're savings. No, we're investing. And, you know, we're abdicating our responsibility for the use of that capital, and we're dependent upon them and their outcomes. Well, it might work out. But then, you know, if I access that money prior to 59 and a half, I'm going to pay penalties. And of course, I'm going to, you know, pay ordinary income tax. I'm going to pay ordinary income tax on the money anyway. So is it really a tax break if I get a tax deduction today and I'm just kicking the calculation off some years into the future? I mean, I'm going to pay taxes. You're going to pay taxes on the money, or your beneficiaries are going to pay taxes on that money when it comes out. Just saying, there may be a better way. If we're separating ourselves from our capital for this time period, because most of America, either most of their wealth resides in qualified retirement plans and or their primary place of residence. So here, if I separated myself from my capital, now, if I want to purchase things and finance things, and let's be crystal clear, everything you purchase, you finance, you either formally finance with somebody else's capital and you pay for that use, or you pay cash. That's a form of financing. I make a purchase, I pay cash. You're still financing it, right? You finance it with cash. You give up all of the interest you could have otherwise earned. So you're either paying interest or giving up interest. There's no exceptions to that. And it would help you or behoove you to understand that and to not only understand it, but understand how financing banking can benefit you and your family. Oh, wait, now that's a bring up the word banking and financing. You look at all of traditional planning, financial planning, personal financial planning, retirement planning, financial planning, whatever you want to call it, all the terminology that is used to describe this relationship between financial institutions and the all-American consumer, rarely, ever, as a matter of fact, I'm inclined to say never, do they discuss the banking function. That banking function is always left out of the equation. Well, I wonder why. Well, if we consider banking then in controlling the banking function as it relates to you and your life, and that's really my underlying encouragement here, is to get you to consider the fact that you can become your own banker. Just because typical traditional financial planning leaves that out, and I'm just questioning why they do that, doesn't mean that you can't control the banking function in your life. As a matter of fact, you can control the banking function in your life. And when you understand that, my encouragement is for you to investigate that idea and that possibility. The benefit to you and your family of controlling the banking function may be bigger than you can imagine. I think it is more beneficial to you and your family by controlling the banking function compared to a lot of these other brain dead ideas that the financial world wants you to participate in. Now, if we consider the infinite banking concept or controlling the banking function in our life, R. Nelson Nash must come up because he created the infinite banking concept, right? He wrote the book, Becoming Your Own Banker, the first work in the infinite banking concept, period. And then he wrote that's Becoming Your Own Banker, right? He wrote a second book, Building a Warehouse of Wealth, and then, you know, the Nelson Nash Institute was formed, and there's been some publications come out of there. The one of them is How Privatized Banking Really Works. And then Nelson also recorded, there's a recording, several actually, of Nelson Nash, who's graduated now. He graduated several years ago. But there are recordings of him presenting the infinite banking concept, how to become your own banker. And you can purchase those, you know, it's DVD, or you can purchase access to that series digitally. And I'm saying all that to say this, that those are the first original works. So if you want to explore the idea of becoming your own banker, start with those and stay on those. Don't go out and buy a bunch of ClickFunnels and all kinds of education you know, series without doing that first, becoming your own banker, building your warehouse of wealth, how privatized banking really works, and a 6.5 hour recorded presentation.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.